public finance and fiscal policy. Now, when we are talking about public finance, I know these are all known things, but still, for the purpose of completeness, very briefly, we are basically talking about the role of state and how state finances its responsibilities and its obligations. Now, if we say that the state has A, B, C, X, Y, Z, there are n number of roles that the state performs. So state requires money. So how do the state get these resources? These resources are appropriated or collected through taxes, through borrowing. And then on the basis of these resources, taxes and borrowing mostly, and then also from external sources like official development assistance and things like that. So when we are talking about fiscal policy, public finance and fiscal policy, three issues becomes very important. One is issues related to taxation, issues related to borrowing. This comes from the part of the resource mobilization because you are mobilizing resources to finance your expenditure. And so once you have decided that these are my expenditure priorities and I in turn want to finance these expenditures based on this level of taxation and this level of borrowing, so that is something which you decide on the basis of your expenditure priorities. Now when you tax in a given system, why do we talk about tax? The given system, the taxation has its own impact on the economy because it may change distribution of income, it may change consumption pattern, it may change, it has its own dead weight loss for the system, for the whole economy. So you decide how to tax so that this dead weight loss, this distortionary impact of taxation can be minimized. And how a taxation can actually really affect a particular group, particular region, particular society, how to take care of the externalities, positive, negative, positive externalities, negative externalities, and things like that. So when you are talking about, so the point which I'm trying to make is that when you are talking about fiscal policy, we are actually talking about fiscal policy in a macroeconomic setting. How one should view fiscal policy from the macroeconomic perspective. So that also I'll talk. And finally, I'll talk about issues related to fiscal space, revenue mobilization, spending, and sustainability. And in that, how do we look into these various aspects of fiscal management? Now, if we talk about pure public finance, if we talk about fiscal tasks of the state are three. One is allocation. So you allocate resources for various sectors. That is provision of public goods. That means the goods which has to be provided by the state, like defense expenditure. It's a pure public good. Private fellow cannot provide defense expenditure because there is no preference for defense. If I am asked whether you need defense expenditure, I'll say yes, I need, but I'll definitely not say how much I need because I cannot quantify it. So there is no market, so no price can be determined for that expenditure. So public goods by nature are non-rival. And if I am enjoying the protection of defense expenditure which the government makes, you are also enjoying the same. So this is non-rival in nature, in consumption, and non-excludable. You cannot exclude a person from the defense expenditure. So when it is non-rival and non-excludable, basically you are not able to set a price for that. So there is a problem of free rider. So in the process, what you do, you tax and finance those expenditures. So that is the allocation part of it. Then there is issue of redistribution, and there is this issue of stabilization. So when we are talking about the role of the states, role of the state is basically allocation, redistribution, and stabilization. And all issues of the state comes into this. Now, the role of the state has expanded. When we talk about Adam Smith and classical macroeconomics, they say that budget should always be balanced. So that means your revenue should determine your expenditure, which is no longer the case. Now all the countries, whether developed or developing, irrespective of their level of development, they have a large government expenditure. And that large government expenditure has happened because there has been a structural change in the economy. There has been democratization of society. There has been concern for social justice, which has increased with economic development. And these are the factors which actually has resulted in an expanded role of the government. So when the government role expands, revenue cannot be a constraint in a strict sense. Because that day we had a seminar here, people were talking about voluntary constraint that government puts, that I cannot borrow beyond a point. So these voluntary constraints are put by the government by its own policy. But actual sense, if we talk about that government has to perform these roles, like allocation, redistribution, and stabilization, in that case, the government role cannot be restricted on the basis of the revenue alone. Now, then the question is, how would be the government expenditure? How much will be the government expenditure? If I have this much of revenue, then the question is how much I can borrow, right? Now, then the question comes, how much you can borrow? Now, there are issues like some school of thought says that you can borrow as much as you want. Some school of thought says, well, you cannot borrow beyond a point, then private investment will not be available if government takes away all the money. So you should restrict your borrowing. And that's the rule of the day today. Everywhere there has been a restriction on borrowing, which is actually limiting government expenditure and the issue of fiscal space, which I'll be talking about. So if we are talking about, so argument of minimal government, such as that what government does, the private sector can do better. But this is the general argument. Well, public sector, they are inefficient. Private sector does it better. So why don't you have a small government, have a large public private sector? So this argument, if we look at in the face of it, it may look, yes, fine, but it can do better are not always a sound proposition. It doesn't happen. I'll come to that. Why? Then there is, I think, excessive, the minimal size of the government in many countries actually has been realized, it has been realized that a reducing size of the government and the declining role of the state in terms of the development activities due to declining fiscal space can have adverse impacts. So now a lot of time people say, while reliance on market is most beneficial, selected government action do spur development. So this issue is coming in. People are trying to say that no, government is important. We need government. So where do we stand? So the point is, at one level, you have a fiscal restriction, like saying that you cannot borrow beyond a point. There is a fiscal restriction. You cannot spend in all the sectors because there are certain sectors where private sector can do better. Then there are fiscal restrictions that government coming in means there is a decline in the growth because the private investment is more efficient than the government investment. So under that situation, under these constraints, which are more or less universal, how do you see the public finance and fiscal policy? Now, if we see the expanded role of the government, it is no longer the allocation, redistribution, and stabilization. Government does all sorts of things. Educational, which the Stiglitz points is this, educational, technological, financial, physical, environmental, social. Fiscal policy can play a vital role in each. Now, if we are talking about fiscal policy can play a vital role in all of these functions that we have said, now the question is, how do they perform this role? One is taxation and borrowing to draw resources for providing public goods and services. So you tax and borrow, which I have already said. Expenditure programs. Apart from the direct expenditure, government can have quasi-fiscal interventions, which I'll come to later. Direct involvement in economic activity. Government can decide, well, I will do it for you. It won't be done by anybody else. Like if the government decides that government will take over the ownership of all the banks, there will be no private banks. There's a government which is providing the financial sector financial services. But we have a combination of banks, which are private sector. We have a combination of banks, which are nationalized. But it may be the case that government decides to provide the financial services publicly. So in that case, we can have an entire public sector-driven financial services in the country. So it is the government which can directly involve in economic activity rather than deciding in a manner that it affects and promotes private sector. So there are conflicting issues. I am not going into that. Now if I say that taxation is the main instrument through which the government should finance its huge expenditure responsibilities. Now the question is, how do you tax? Can the government tomorrow say that I will tax Pinaki's income at 90% rate? So if my income tax goes up to 90%, I may well decide that I'll stay at home, I'll not come to the office, right? So there has to be some principles of taxation which actually doesn't adversely affect incentive to work and thereby growth. So when you're talking about the fiscal space, this issue becomes very important that there are constraints to taxation which we have to understand. Now, a lot of people, lot of discussions that goes on, that fiscal space is very little for the developing countries. Fiscal space is very little for the developing countries. Why not developing countries mobilize more and more taxes? Now, this is very easy to say, but very difficult to do, because the structure of the economy of developing countries are very different than a formal economy that we see in the developed world. So under that itself limits the level of revenue mobilization. Isn't it? Don't you think so? That if you have a large informal sector, that actually reduces the tax base? So if you have a large informal sector, that reduces the tax base. Then you tax only very few sectors. So under that situation, what is happening is that, well, it may sound very odd, but the point is that there are certain economic activities. In a pure economic sense, if we talk about, there are certain economic activities which you are trying to promote, and there are certain economic activities you are actually adversely affecting through the taxation because they are not under the tax nets. So there are limits to taxation. You cannot tax beyond a point because that will adversely affect the incentive to work and growth. As I said, that if my income tax is 95%, I would decide to stay at home. I will not come to the office to work. Similarly, there could be a constraint that is arising out of the structure of the economy. So taxation we cannot just say that Scandinavian countries tax at up to 50% of their GDP is their tax revenue. Why can't India do it? Or why can't South Africa do it? Or why can't some other developing country do it? So that's not possible. There are constraints to taxation. Now when you say taxation as an instrument and its objective, what should be its objective? Need to raise revenue irrespective of the forms of government. Whether it is a unitary government, whether it is a federal government, whether it is a large government, whether it is a small government, there is a need to raise revenues because these revenues are providing the certain public services which the government is supposed to provide. Now, when you say that I raise revenue, revenue should be raised equitably and fairly. It should not adversely impact the economic incentive to work and also a particular sector vis-a-vis other sector. For example, if we say that we tax goods and we don't want to tax services, that means through taxation, you are actually trying to distort the choice of an individual economic agent to decide whether he'll do his business in goods or in services, right? So when you are taxing, you should raise revenues in an equitable and fair manner and minimize the cost of raising taxes, because taxation requires tax administrative machinery. So you must reduce the collection cost of taxes, desire to encourage or discourage particular economic activity, particular groups and regions. Through taxation, you can try to encourage a particular economic activity. Through taxation, you can prefer a certain group, or you can prefer certain regions. You give area-based exemption. If you set up an industry here, I'll not tax you because the area is underdeveloped. So if an industry come, I'll not tax you. Some of the states in large countries like India, we see, some of the states say, you come and set up industries here, I'll not tax you. So you are trying to prefer a particular group. This can be absolutely distortionary. I'm not going into that. But taxation can be used as a tool to prefer a certain group, certain region, certain activities. So it has a wide role. But basic idea is when you are taxing, taxation should be fair and equitable. And that is the issue of gender and taxation, which I'll talk about in the next session. Okay. Now, if we see the level, structure, and need, some major points, if we look at, around 20% of the GDP all over the world, this is the 167 countries data that I have taken. If we look at, on an average, 20% of GDP is collected as taxes. Now, this can go as low as 10% in some countries, and it can go high as low as 40% for many countries. Broadly, the tax ratio varies due to income level. Countries with higher income generally has higher tax ratio, but countries with rich natural resources also have a high tax ratio vis-a-vis other countries. Now, what is the revenue need? What determines revenue need? When you say that tax ratio is 20%, in our country, tax ratio is roughly 20% of GDP. Then what does that mean? what is the revenue need? This revenue need differs across countries for many factors, including economic structure, I said, formal, informal, location of the country, capacity to administer, public service delivery need, how much public services you want to provide. Universal education, if you want to provide, you require a lot of money. Whether you want to provide that or not, that's a political decision that you take. And if you are taking that political decision, you have to collect more taxes. Now, whether you want to do it or not, that's an issue which is not public finance, which is political. So, so these are certain basic things. Now, if we look at the developing countries, what are the major problems? Informal economy is a much larger fraction of the GDP. High fraction of revenue coming from few large firms, if we look at. Lack of information on potential taxpayers, huge evasions, weak domestic financial institutions. Then you use non-traditional sources of revenue, like you monetize your deficits, you apply high tariffs, and then you have a lot of fees. So you see that in developing countries, share of government financing of deficit, monetization will be very, very high compared to a developed economy. But this happens not because the economy, the concerned government is not aware of the relationship between fiscal and monetary policy. I'm not taking a position on that. I'll come to that later. But the point is that there is a constraint to revenue mobilization in different countries. So when you're talking about fiscal space and particular government expenditure program, that issue in a specific country context has to be taken into consideration. Now, when you say equity, fairness, and cost of collection, first issue is that as taxes impose real cost to the society, good tax policy try to minimize that cost. We have read in the optimal tax theory that there is a deadweight loss when you are taxing, so nobody gains out of it. So the idea is that you try to minimize that loss because taxes influence the before tax distribution of income by changing economic incentives. As I said, if my income tax rate is 90%, I will decide that I'll stay at home. So it is deciding my economic incentive to work or not, and also influence the after-tax distribution of income. If there is a progressive income tax, it may so happen that distribution of income becomes more equitable after you have imposed the tax. So it affects your economic incentive to work. It also affects the distribution of income, post-tax distribution of income. So you have to be very careful what kind of tax you are going to impose in your country. So that is very important. So these are issues which we'll briefly discuss. Though equity and efficiency primarily should guide tax policy design, administrative feasibility is another key criteria in designing tax systems. Of late, what is happening with globalization, if you look at that, lot of this is basically the World Bank and IMF position. They say that don't worry about bringing equity through taxation. Don't say that I'll tax the rich at 70% and the poor at 30%. You tax everybody at a range between 20 to 30. But that will help you reduce your number of rates. So if you are reducing your number of rates, your tax administration becomes easier, right? If you have too many rates, the tax administration becomes complicated. So you have one rate or two rates. So that's what you see, that number of rates all over the world is coming down, whether for the direct taxes or for the indirect taxes. Now the idea is efficiency. VAT, all over the world there is a moving towards a value-added tax. I have no problem with the value-added tax. Value-added tax, through value-added tax, you really cannot have equity because value-added tax talks about single rate. Idea is, when I'm a single rate, if you say that, why single rate? They will say that it is single rate because you are giving tax credit. So how does it matter whether I am taxing input differently or output differently? I should tax. So if I have a single rate, I have a simple tax system. I mobilize more revenues. Through that, I should do a greater expenditure transfers, which should take care of equity. So I should look at the expenditure budget, not the tax side. So that's the idea. Maybe there are arguments. Now the question is, it is all right if you don't have a constraints of deficits, right? If you say You cannot increase your government expenditure beyond a point. Then it happens that you mobilize taxes to cover your deficit. You may not be increasing your expenditure in an effective manner. Is that right? Okay. So, I skip this slide. You can look at this. Now, three general rules. How do you minimize cost of taxation? Tax base should be as broad as possible. And it is distortion minimizing. This I agree, because you bring more and more economic activity under the tax net. So you say that I tax this, I don't tax that. It becomes a major problem. So you are actually using your discretion as a government. So if you have a broad tax base and a low rate, actually you are treating everyone in an equal manner. Whether that is fair and unfair is a different question. But the point is that idea is that you broaden the base. So that is what is happening. You see all over the world there has been a reduction in rate. And you are bringing in more and more income, more and more consumption, various goods and services under the tax net, both in the direct and indirect taxes. Setting tax rates as low as possible, given the revenue rate for government operation. Careful attention should be given on taxes on production, because production decisions like excise, you apply, this is a tax on production. Now, how that tax will be decided, that will have an effect on the location of business, alter the ways in which production takes place, changes the form in which business is conducted. Production tax is easy to administer and less expensive to collect. So when we talk about developing countries, you will see their tax structure, you will see excise duty. Production tax is a very high proportion because it is very easy to collect. You go to the factory gate and you collect the taxes. You know how much is the production. You will see customs duty is very easy to collect. So depend more and more trade taxes, because trade taxes are very easy to collect because this is on the port. But this could be very distortion. This can bring in a lot of distortions in the economic system. That is the other argument that they say. So I'll come to that little later in the discussion maybe. Now I think more important issue when we are talking about in tax policy is the issue of fairness concern. How fair is the tax policy? So one is the horizontal and vertical equity. Horizontal equity requires that those who are in similar circumstances to pay similar amount of taxes. So I work, my wife works, both of us have some amount of income, we both pay the same amount of taxes, right? So we are taxed at the same rate. So we say that, well, this is horizontal equity. But there may be a situation where I work, my wife doesn't work, I am taxed at the same rate with a lower income, right? It's a very simple example, we can go into that. So in that case, what is happening? Overall tax burden goes high. Is much higher. So the point is, horizontal equity requires that those who are in similar circumstances to pay similar amount of taxes. Vertical equity requires appropriate differences among taxpayers in different economic circumstances. That's why I was giving in family structure and income level. To determine fairness, one must consider economic incidence of taxation. How do you judge whether a tax system is fair or unfair? If you have to judge whether a tax system is fair or unfair, you need to look at the economic incidence of taxation. From the perspective of social and economic, and we have done a study on economic incidence of taxation that I'll talk later on gender and taxation lecture later. From the perspective of social and economic inequality, both expenditure and tax policy should be considered to understand their effect on distribution of income. So when you are talking about fiscal policy and public finance, it cannot be only taxes, it has to be both tax and expenditure, and we must look at the issue of net fiscal benefit. So when we are talking about tax incidence, we shouldn't forget that government also does a lot of expenditure functions to various regions and groups, which in turn actually may alter the question of fairness in a very significant way. So we must look at the net fiscal benefit, not only the taxation and its incidence. So when we are talking about tax and fairness concern, I think we have to look at the whole budget, not only the tax, both tax as well as expenditure. Now, when we talk about, let me give a basic understanding of economic incidence. It will help me in the later lecture. Just economic incidence of taxation is a tax burden fall on individual as consumer, It can fall as producer. It can fall as a supplier of factors of production, not on corporation and other institution, because they pass on the tax liability depending on the supply and demand elasticities of product. Now, liability to pay does not necessarily mean bearing of economic incidence of taxes. For example, you go to a store and buy something, pay the tax to the store owner, right? And he pays the tax. But his liability to pay does not mean that he is bearing the incidence. Incidence is on you because you have paid the tax. But you cannot go and individually pay the tax to the government because he is registered with the government, so he goes and pays the tax. So liability to pay does not necessarily mean bearing of economic incidence of taxation. Although VAT law requires payment of taxes in the entire production and distribution chain, the real economic incidence fall on the consumer. So that has to be understood. There are incidents when the economic incidence is unclear. For example, property tax. Maybe the owner of the land and capital are by the users of renters of the property, depending on the market condition. Who stays in that house? He pays the property tax. Market condition is critical. Who actually bears the tax incidence, depending on the supply and demand elasticities. So the tax system can be used to encourage or discourage certain activities, correct for market failures, such as positive and negative externalities, for example, pollution. Countries use tax provision to encourage larger families. Retirement savings. In our country, there is a retirement saving. If you save for your retirement, you get tax benefits in your income taxes. Capital investment. If you invest home ownership, in our country, if income tax is exempted, the amount of money you have borrowed to buy a loan and the EMI you pay on that part is exempted from taxes. Now, secondly, in our country also there is the stamp duty and registration fee to register property. If it is registered in the name of a woman in many states, the stamp duty is lower. But if it is registered in the name of a man, it is higher. So you are trying to encourage ownership by women through the taxation. So tax can be used for many non-tax objectives. So that is the point I am trying to say. Providing tax incentive for particular activities. Many countries have tax expenditure budget. In India also we have the tax expenditure budget to account for cost of provision that are used to promote non-tax objectives. Suppose I give tax exemption. How much taxes I have foregone because of the tax exemption is the tax expenditure. Otherwise, this would have come as a revenue. So in a lot of countries, you will see tax expenditure. Now, I told that lower rate for registration of property by women. Now, how much of the tax expenditure that the government has incurred? That kind of data is also available. Actually, one can look at which one is more progressive. Is it the tax expenditure or is it the direct expenditure programs? So those things are really possible to do because you get data on tax expenditure. Now, finally, on tax, globalization and tax base. This is something which is very interesting in the sense that due to the global integration, the tax base, or rather the space for having an independent tax policy, is substantially reduced. Globalization requires that you cannot have tariff walls, right? So you have to reduce your customs duty, right? Your import tariff has to be reduced. So you bring your import tariff to a level which is very low so that you promote trade, you promote global integration through trade. So when you do that, in a developing country context, where you see on an average one-third of the revenue comes from customs, it goes, right? So the point is, when you are having a global integration, you are actually reducing. You cannot have an independent tax policy. I will not say reducing. You cannot have an independent tax policy. It has to be designed in a global context. That is one. Second issue is, when we are having a global tax policy in a global setting, the other problem that happens is that you introduce VAT. Now, what does VAT say? VAT says that you treat, sorry? Exactly. Exactly. But what about export? Export? You zero rate export. Now, I buy a camera from US. I go to the counter in the airport. I show my receipt. They give me back the tax I have paid because that is being exported. Now, this product which I have exported from US for my own consumption in India is not taxed anywhere because I am not going to pay the tax in my home country, right? Now, when you say that a zero rate export for export competitiveness or a destination-based principle, that means where it is consumed, there it will be taxed. Then the question is, are we taxing import as a domestic product? Do we tax import as a domestic product? Imports are not taxed as domestic products. So automatically, your tax base shrinks. So you are reducing your customs duty, so you cannot tax your import. And when you are, because of globalization, now when imports are to be taxed as a domestic product, is not done because imports are not taxed in a domestic situation. So you are not having import duty. You are also not benefited out of the zero rating of export and the introduction of VAT. So this is another issue. Third issue is that in a large country, I come from a very large country, so the problem is India. So there are 28 states. Now you say that tax policy should be simple. You have one rate for throughout the country. You know there is a telephone provider in our country which says one country, one rate, 1 rupee per minute. So you talk all over the country, the telephone provider. Now the tax policy also has become like that, one country, one rate. Now the point is when you have one country, one rate, I will say a state which has a very low fiscal capacity, if it is also taxing at the same rate, and the state which has a very high tax capacity also taxing at the same rate, isn't that unequal? Because the capacity, public service delivery need in these two states are very different. Because one is poor, other is rich. And then you are forcing both the states to tax at the same rate. Which is, if we take this in the country context, the same logic applies. So I'm saying that globalization has brought in all sorts of constraints for an independent tax policy, especially for the developing countries. So your fiscal space is shrinking. Now, when your fiscal space is shrinking, what do you do? Yes, Rashid? You cannot increase taxes because we have globalized. No, what do you do? Okay, we borrow more, but how do you borrow? That is the outcome. So before that, you can borrow. Yes, right, you can borrow. But how do you borrow? You have a fiscal responsibility rule. You cannot borrow beyond a point. So your expenditure is residual. So in such a situation, talking about fiscal policy becomes extremely, the expenditure is a residual. Even though there is a large government that we talk about after Second World War, but the development that has taken place in the last 20 years, rather, you see that government expenditure has become a residual concern. Can I ask something? Yes. Do you want some questions while you are talking or at the end? No, this is one part. The tax part I have finished. So now I'll talk about sustainability of the fiscal sustainability. I think I'll take questions now. Yes.
I want to raise three points. In the presentation, you told us that direct taxation was distortionary because they tax whatever they find. But I think indirect taxes are more distortionary than that, as it taxes everybody regardless of their income, such as in my country. You said developing countries are relying on direct taxes. I find it more equitable than indirect tax because in Turkey it is just the contrary. Maybe I misunderstood. Our tax base is so narrow that government tries to raise taxes through the value-added tax and consumption, and this kills people. Also, for the informal sector, in my country, there's a you know, discussion go, yes, let's lower the rates and make it, take the informal economy and unofficial economy into official sphere. But there is a trade-off there because informal sector provides employment and government wants people to work, although they don't pay taxes. So there's a trade-off there, and this is a very hard thing to resolve. And as for the globalization thing, development that reduces the tax base is that the production is shifted to places where lower rates are prevailing. So, for example, in our country, factories are shut down, and it's shifted to Romania or China. So we are losing tax base in that respect as well.
You have very, very pointed questions so that we...
You have mentioned in your presentation that the country location matters is finance. Maybe I did not catch the exact idea of this. Can you expand? Thank you.
Import has to be treated as a domestic commodity. Yeah. Then only you can tax as import. In many of the developing countries, tariff walls have been dismantled, but imports are not taxed as domestic products. That is the point which I was trying to say. So in that case, what is happening is that your export is zero-rated. You are having a destination-based consumption principle. I don't know what the situation in your country, but in our country, imports are not taxed as a domestic product. The states do not have the right to tax import. But exports are zero-rated, and you don't have a tariff wall. So under that situation, your tax base automatically shrinks. That is the point which I was trying to say.
Okay.
Yeah, second issue is that, no, I did not say that issue of distortion in that sense. What I said is that direct taxes, I am saying that if you have a selective taxation, I tax this, I tax, don't tax that, that the government is using a discretion. That government thinks this is good, this is bad. For example, if you say that I tax goods at a higher rate than the services, so you are... What economic logic would that be? Which one is more important? That's the political decision you are taking. That I think services are to be taxed at a lower rate. But there you are using discretion. The point which I'm trying to say is that if you want to have a non-distortionary tax policy, you should have a tax rate which is lower and also not selective. That is the point I'm trying to say. Right? And second issue is that direct tax is more progressive than progressivity cannot be achieved through the indirect taxation. Progressivity can be achieved through direct taxation. Because indirect taxation doesn't say who is poor and who is non-poor. So it is the direct tax which is the main instrument. But what I was talking about distortion and non-distortion, it was actually related to selective taxation. Okay. Yes, I fully agree with the informal sector because... It's a big problem of choice because the point is that when you have a large informal sector, you don't have taxes. Now, whether tax policy can make them formal, can bring them into the formal sector, a lot of people say VAT can do it. How? Because they say that if you come under the VAT, you will get tax credit, you will have lower tax, but I don't know whether that works or not. And I fully agree with you. This I should have mentioned, and I thank you so much for that. That reduction of tax base, not only globalization has not only reduced the tax base by reducing the rate, but it also shifted production from a region which has a high tax to a region which has a low tax. Because of the global integration, you can produce wherever you want. So, yeah, that has happened, and that has again created problems. For some countries benefited. So net effect, we don't know. Country location, I say that, yes, country location matters because if it is a landlocked country, a small country, which depends entirely on import from other countries, their tax structure is determined by the location itself, you know. So, for example, Nepal, it's landlocked. Everything comes from India. So in that case, if we are talking about tax base, location, a country which is very resource rich, suppose it is on the, in many countries in the Middle East, oil rich countries, by sheer location, they have a huge tax revenue whenever the oil prices go up. So location of the country does matter. That's the point which I was trying to say. Fiscal sustainability. I have a PhD student. One day she came and I was busy with some work. Of course, she didn't take a prior appointment. So I said that, why don't you look at fiscal sustainability? Then she asked me, do you know what is fiscal sustainability? I said, no. Then she said, you must first read. So, no, I have a PhD student. One day she came and she works on fiscal issues in India. So she came and I was busy with some work and I didn't have, she didn't have a prior appointment. So I just wanted to avoid the discussion because I was terribly busy. So I told her, why don't you look at fiscal sustainability? Then she said, do you know what is fiscal sustainability? Then I said, I don't. Then she said, you must read. Issue is fiscal sustainability. What is sustainable? What is unsustainable? Can anyone say that, well, 60% of debt GDP ratio, which is decided in the Maastricht Treaty, is sustainable, but 90% is unsustainable? How sustainability gets reflected? Who knows what is sustainable? Is there any benchmark, any thumb rule, or any theoretical proposition which would tell you that this is sustainable, this is unsustainable? No. What is your fiscal space? It is again a subjective concept. Though we are talking about numbers, we don't know. Fiscal space, how much you want to have, is up to you. So these are two issues. I want to discuss these two concerns. One is that deficit and its macroeconomic implication. So when we are talking about unsustainability, deficit becomes unsustainable. That means deficit has an adverse macroeconomic impact, right? Deficit increases debt. Debt is a stock, deficit is a flow. So deficit and its macroeconomic implication. Now what happens if the government borrows more when you are talking about fiscal space? What can happen if the government borrows more? Yeah, domestic, let's say domestic. No. Yeah. What happens if the government borrows more?
Now, of course, when government borrows a lot of money from the public, all the money will be concentrated in the hands of the public, I mean government. Therefore, there will be no money left for maybe public to borrow and reinvest to create, to generate more resources for the economy.
Okay, so the argument is that it will crowd out the private investment. That is one of the arguments. And that is the principal argument why you say that government should borrow less. That it will, thank you. And so one is that your rate of interest will go up if you borrow. Your public investment will crowd out private investment. So economy will go into a lower level of equilibrium, right? Yes.
Interest, you know, government pays interest for the borrowing, and this interest expenditures become so much that after some point in time, the government allocates the expenditures that it goes to public education, investment, etc., to interest payments, because there's nothing to be done for the interest payments. It is there, it should be paid, but we can cut the expenditures going to social expenditures. That's primary.
This you are saying, thank you very much that you raised this, but this you are saying because there is an implicit assumption in your mind that government cannot borrow. Right? Isn't it? when my share of interest payment going up in my total revenue, that means I have an artificial restriction already put in my borrowing. No, no, deficit is always a flow. We are talking about. Interest payment is again a flow. Interest payment, she talked about interest payment. So your stock of debt, when your stock of debt increases, your interest payment goes up, right? Now, if your interest payment goes up, you are saying other expenditures will come down because the share has gone up. That actually is a question which assumes in the back of mind that I cannot borrow beyond a point so that I can increase my fiscal space. This is precisely the point I'm trying to say. The point is that when you are putting an artificial restriction on yourself, your other expenditures will go down. So, why yes?
Can I just make one thing comment? I think I'm stopping Valeria from continuing the conversation, but I think to some degree, there are many countries that face the following constraint. You cannot continue borrowing to service your debt because when you have a debt to GDP ratio that goes above a certain percent, which is how you started your presentation, you get locked out of all kinds of markets. And then in order to be able to attract capital, you have to increase your interest rates even more. And when you increase your interest rates even more, then your exchange rate and so on. And so I think that was the
What I'm trying to say is, theoretically speaking, if we are talking about tax and borrowing is a deferred taxation. From wherever you borrow, it doesn't matter. Let us take it very simply. It is a deferred taxation because at this level, to finance all the government expenditure commitments, I cannot borrow, I cannot tax my people up to the 100% of their income. So if I have to tax up to 30% of their income, and after that if I have a deficit, that I should cover by borrowing. But ultimately, borrowing has to be serviced by taxation. So that's why we say borrowing is a deferred taxation. Now when we say that borrowing has to be serviced by taxation, it is the question, how much of your incremental borrowing is resulting in increase in your taxes? Don't you think so? Yes.
Borrowing just for the sake of borrowing and running kind of a Ponzi scheme with their debt. The question is also, what do you do with your borrow? What did you do with the money that you borrow? If you created productive capacity, then in the future you're going to be collecting higher taxes. So what is also important is, what did you do with the borrowing?
Absolutely.
From external
That's
sources.
Why it is That's a relationship between. Different. Absolutely. That is why it is a relationship between growth and borrowing. I'm coming to that precisely. The point is, so borrowing, when I'm borrowing, incremental borrowing is actually the question of how much my future tax liability will go up because of the borrowing that I'm making today. Now, if I can make sure that my future tax liability doesn't go up, then I have no restriction on borrowing. First. Second point is that, how would your future tax liability not go up? How? Because your tax base has to increase. So how would the tax base increase? Tax base increase if the growth increases. So that brings the issue of use of borrowed resources. So if the borrowed resources are used in a productive manner, which contributes to growth, and in turn the tax revenue mobilization goes up, you have no problem. So if I look, if I take this issue, this is the condition. This is the incremental tax rate that you require. That is, alpha is the rate of borrowing, R is the rate of growth, I is the real rate of interest. If you can look at this article, tax rate, so the point is, as long as the real rate of growth of the economy, this can be derived. I have derived it. The equations are there, but I am not going to explain that because that will be very boring. So if the point is that if the real rate of growth of the economy is more than the real rate of interest, you have no problem with borrowing. Now, if we look at any country, for that matter, where there is artificial restrictions on borrowing, the difference between growth and the rate of interest is always positive. Despite of there is an artificial restriction on borrowing, and then you say that, I don't have the fiscal space. That is the point which I am trying to say. So the point is, when we are talking about borrowing, don't restrict the fiscal policy parameters in terms of the expenditure side of the budget. I think it is more important to look at the tax side of the budget. Now, when your tax base is shrinking, you naturally, even if your growth increases, it may so happen that you are not able to increase your tax ratio. You are not able to increase your tax effort. So if you are not able to increase your tax effort, naturally that artificial restriction of borrowing becomes even more concrete, even more problematic. So actually it stuck to here. So that is the issue. In India, I'm telling you, I have looked at the data. During the 90s, your tax ratio fell like anything. So it was something like 11%, it came down to 8%, 9%. 12%, 9% in 10 years. And that means 3% of extra GDP you have to borrow to finance your expenditure. You couldn't do it. Your government expenditure drastically fell because you have a restriction, because you have a structural adjustment program, so you cannot borrow. So how did you cut your how did you bring your fiscal deficit down when your taxes are falling? You cut your development spending, which has created, and there are a lot of work which actually talks about declining social sector spending, its impact on education, its impact on health, its impact on various sectors. So this is this happened when you have an artificial restriction. So the point is that when I'm borrowing, it has to be productive use, and that should result in higher revenue mobilization. In turn, it should not create any problem. Now, if you look at the debt sustainability literature, other than Domer in 1944, the literature hasn't developed. Now, if we look at all the IMF debt sustainability literature, it's hilarious. Here, they have an intertemporal budget constraint. Intertemporal budget constraint is a dynamic constraint. Now, in that dynamic constraint, they put a growth of GDP, which is constant. They assume for the next 10 years, GDP, nominal GDP will grow at 14%. I'm giving you an example how unsustainability becomes an issue. Nominal GDP will grow at 14%. So you assume nominal GDP growing at 14%. Then you say that your expenditure elasticity is more than your income elasticity, that means your revenue elasticity. Now you put those two numbers, which is expenditure elasticity and the revenue elasticity, into the intertemporal budget constraints, right? Then you get a path of deficit, which will be obviously unsustainable, because the point is, when you say my expenditure elasticity, this point is very important. When you say that your expenditure elasticity is more than the revenue elasticity, that and you put it into the budget constraint, you are getting a higher deficit every year, right? But then when you are making the assumption about GDP, you are making the assumption that GDP will grow at a constant rate. What does that mean? That means that incremental borrowing is for unproductive purposes. That assumption is implicit. When I have an increasing borrowing assumption and we have a constant GDP growth in the model, you get a situation which is implicit. They never say, which is implicit. But that means that you are borrowing for unproductive purposes, because my deficit is growing up, but I have a constant GDP growth rate. So what will be the result? Obviously, it will be unsustainable. So any paper from any working paper of IMF, if you look at, all the countries did are unsustainable. So then you bring that assumption. By assumption. India, a lot of people worked on unsustainability. Everybody assumes the same thing. Why can't you dynamize the GDP growth in that model? You may get a very different result. Then you say that you bring in fiscal responsibility rule. So that's the issue. Now, if we look at this budget constraint, if we look at this dynamic budget constraint that they were talking about, the debt GDP ratio depends on the stock of debt. Interest rate, interest payment divided by the stock of debt of previous year, and this is the primary deficit. The last term is the primary deficit, because that is divided by GDP. So primary deficit to GDP ratio. Now what do they say? They say that, well, interest rate is, so the question is, I go back to the last equation, where it says that R should be greater than I. So in this case, K should be greater than I. That means the real rate of growth of the economy should be higher than the interest rate. So if the real rate of growth of the economy is higher than the interest rate, debt is sustainable. But what is the standard orthodox position? Position is, you cannot alter K. You cannot alter I. So what you can only alter, which is in your control, is the deficit, primary deficit. So what you try to do, you try to reduce your primary deficit. So that's why you always hear about bring in primary surplus. So the point is that even if you bring I and K, even if the I and K have the sustainability condition, that means K is greater than I, that means the economy is growing at a higher rate than the real rate of interest, you still have a primary fiscal restriction, because this is very easy to control. Yes. No, I'm not saying that this equation works, but I'm talking about the relationship. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, fine. Yes, good.
Corruption money, because you don't pay debt, or you don't put it into anything productive for the country.
You cannot, alter growth, because they, like these, you know, mainstream economists will just look at the average and then say, okay, you know, since the last 20 years, the growth rate is 2.5, it has to be 2.5. Is that the reasoning behind why you cannot alter these two?
This is the normal standard argument, whatever, where they say that economy grows at a natural rate. It is difficult to alter it in the short run. Natural rate of interest. So you are not exclusively under the control of the fiscal authority. So what do? By achieving primary surplus. Achieving primary balance depends on the fiscal authority. They can always cut their expenditure. You cannot increase taxes because we have constraint of globalization. Yes.
Could you briefly explain for us what structural deficit and primary surplus is?
Okay. That is, primary surplus is...
economics background in the room. Okay. There are 3-4 people that do not have an economics background. So just for the benefit of...
If we take the total government expenditure... If we take the total government expenditure and all non-debt receipts, non-debt receipts means revenue that you are getting and also proceeds from your disinvestment. Lot of countries do disinvestment. Then recovery of loans and advances. That is your fiscal deficit. That is your total borrowing requirement. That means this is the aggregate gap. Now, from this aggregate gap, if you take out the interest payment, that becomes the primary deficit. Because the argument is, interest payment depends on the past debt. So present government cannot do anything with it. So what you should be targeting, not the fiscal deficit, but the primary deficit. So you achieve primary surplus. This is a dangerous concept. Because if your interest payment goes up, you will have a primary surplus. And you will say, I'm doing very well. Actually, you have no money left for any other government expenditure. So this is a very dangerous concept. So you cannot do that. So the third issue, yes.
I just want to
wanted to tell very shortly that the same situation is in the European Union for the new access, new countries. And you have just the same mechanism, because you have Maastricht criteria, which were set for countries which were, you know, France, Germany, the developed countries at the time when there was a big stability. There was no crisis, no situation. Now you have a new countries like Poland, Czech Republic, etc. And then you ask these countries with a much lower level of income to catch up, and they have to finance somehow the process. And you have the restrictions. So there's no other mean if they have to comply, because they are pushed to comply. So even now, there was a very interesting new publication of Bruegel Institute in Brussels, which is just looking into this issue about accessing to the Eurozone or not accessing, and what were the costs for the new countries. And it happened that in the discussion on this issue, even now France and Germany especially had problems. They are not so happy with the Maastricht criteria, because how we are going to finance. So I think it's not an issue uniquely typical for developing countries. I wanted just, it's a mechanism which works everywhere.
I have 30 more minutes? Okay, very good.
I think what happens in African countries is, of course, they are not allowed to borrow. They have to fit with the conditionality of globalization. So more and more they are pushing actually the tax collection on people, on poor people. Mm. And people are really choked, because on one side they are paying so much taxes, because they just tax the whole tax base. Everyone pays the same rate, but also there are so many other hidden taxes, which, you know, in terms of cost recovery, user fee. So really, it is becoming impossible for people to survive. And I think that, you know, when they calculate poverty and look at income, but they don't look at disposable income, this is also part of the problem.
I think two points. One is, I think this whole issue of debt sustainability is very, very important, and it's quite political. Huh? It's a very serious issue. Absolutely. Because the question about reduction of debt servicing and the possibility for accumulating new debt, both for the financial crisis as well as in terms of climate change financing, right? When you have to do the co-financing of climate, of your adaptation or mitigation strategy. But we've been arguing for a long time within the debt movement about opening up the issue of debt sustainability, not in that very narrow quantitative way, but actually putting in new parameters of debt sustainability that looks at the transfer burden of the debt, that include issues that would take into account poverty, opening up the parameters, introducing new other variables that will widen the scope from that very limited way that it's presented. And part of what you're illustrating, which I think is great, is a lot of our governments don't realize that the constraints are political, it's not economics. These are political constraints that are put on us. And we buy these things, and then we knock ourselves into these little parameters and end up choking off our own economic growth and accepting certain kinds of constraints around debt forgiveness and all that kind of nonsense. Huh? Okay.
Okay. I think the other issue is the fiscal policy cannot be looked in isolation from the monetary policy. Now, if we look at the fiscal and monetary linkages, you see there is a huge restriction that has been put on the functioning of the government due to the central bank autonomy argument. So you give the central bank greater autonomy, let them have an independent monetary policy, let them control inflation, let them target inflation targeting and all that, and they shouldn't be supporting government borrowing program, because that actually increases money supply. Now, what happened in many countries, that day James Sainz was talking about banks holding excess reserves. Now, you see, there are three issues why this financial liberalization has affected the interest rate. Now, we are talking about financing of deficit. I have talked about debt sustainability. So from there, I'll go to that issue of fiscal and monetary linkages. Now, if we look at bond financing, argument is that if you finance more by bonds, it increases interest rate. So private investment goes down, you go into a lower level of equilibrium. Very simple. Second issue is money financing. That means that is called synodage. So you ask your central bank that print money, give it to me, I'll finance government expenditure program. So this is a cheap resource that was available to many of the countries prior to the wave of financial liberalization, which is no longer available now. Now, external financing may often widen the current account deficit and exchange rate management may become difficult. So each financing mode has its own macroeconomic impact. Now, what is the ideal combination? So if you say that, well, these are all true, this may not be true. If we say that these are all true, then you need to have an ideal combination of bond, ideal combination of money, and ideal combination of external finance. Now, what happens? Why emphasis on bond financing? Why can't you have monetization? Argument is to reduce monetization and thus creation of reserve money into the system. People are talking about high-powered money coming in, that is increasing money supply, creating inflation. This is a very straightforward, simple argument, but it doesn't work like that. In developing countries, most of the time you see inflation is structural in nature. So you say that, okay, so money supply, increase in money supply may contribute to the growth in output. So, but that may not be happening. So greater autonomy to the central bank to pursue an independent monetary policy. One really doesn't know what that means. Basically, you want a stable inflation rate for the private sector to grow, which may not happen. So activation of internal debt market by widening investors' base for government securities. So how do you do that? You say that? Well, the central bank shouldn't monetize deficit. Then how do you finance deficit? Government has a deficit. How do you finance it? You say, okay, we will try to finance it by increasing, making the government securities attractive. So if the government securities become attractive, everybody will go and buy government securities. So how do you make it attractive? You deregulate. You deregulate the interest rate. So in our country it happened. When 91 structural adjustment started, deregulated interest rate, government security, which was at 5 to 8% rate of interest in different maturity, averaged around 8% in 1988-89. In 93, it was 14%. 700 basis point increase in 5 years. And when it became 14%, government said, your point, interest payment has gone up. I cannot increase my deficit. I cannot spend on health. I cannot spend on education. But your interest payment has gone up because you are buying high-cost debt, with the idea that you are going to invest in, you are going to increase the investor's base for government securities. Now, when you are trying to increase the investor's base for government securities and trying to make it attractive, then what happens? Second round effect. Second round effect is banks find it more attractive to invest in government securities other than giving credit. So credit becomes, availability of credit becomes, it becomes scarce. It becomes even less. So under such a situation, what happens? There is a credit squeeze on the monetary side, and there is a fiscal squeeze on the fiscal side because of these kind of policy changes. So overall fiscal space goes down. Right? Now there is another problem. Another problem in the sense that when you have this, you have a high interest rate, the issue of capital flows, so capital starts coming in. So your foreign exchange reserve goes up. So when your foreign exchange reserve goes up, what happens? Your reserve money doesn't go down. So even if you want to increase credit, you will not be able to do it as an independent central bank. So your policy shift focus from monetization of deficit to exchange rate management. How much you will sterilize and how much you will not sterilize. That becomes the everyday discussions. The issues related to growth and the challengization of credit takes a backseat. This is what is happening after the financial liberalization in many countries, and especially in my country. So what do? You don't have a cheap credit, so you cannot monetize your deficit. So we have a legislation through an agreement government and RBI, Reserve Bank of India, has decided that they will not monetize deficit. There's an agreement between the government and... So there is no government bond which RBI holds now. Reserve Bank of India, which is the central bank of our country, holds now. They don't hold any government bond. Now, who holds these government bonds? These government bonds are there with the private banks. Commercial banks. Now, commercial banks are holding excess reserves in terms of government securities because they are very safe. Now, when they are holding excess reserves, your argument of investors' base for government security did not expand. So there could be a collusive oligopoly. These two or three guys deciding the rate of interest. There is no market. There is no market. So you don't know whether that interest rate which you are paying, whether that is a market rate of interest or is a rate of interest which is decided by these three banks.
But there is no independent central bank.
Absolutely. So that is what is happening. Second round effect. When you are not having monetization, you don't have cheap access to cheap credit, and then what happens? You are holding these foreign exchange reserves. Now, when you are holding these foreign exchange reserves, that has a huge cost. Now, if this level of monetization, if the composition of reserve money would have been different, that means if you had more of credit to the government and less of foreign exchange reserve, you don't need that much, then what would have happened is that central bank would have earned profit by borrowing to the government. And that money would have come back to the government because that is a quasi-fiscal authority. So that would have, again, reduced your fiscal deficit. Now, some estimates in India shows that it's huge. This quasi-fiscal cost of holding foreign exchange reserve is half the NREGI expenditure. It's around 20,000 crores of rupees. 20,000 crores means how many billion? 200 million rupees, right? Yeah. 2,000 million rupees. So that money the government is losing. So that is what is another issue that has happened. Now, there was this question of developing countries grew in the last couple of years, and that has helped in terms of their revenue mobilization. And the kind of fiscal restriction the Fiscal Responsibility and Budget Management Act has put could have created havoc if the revenue would not have grown as they have grown in the last few years for many countries. That is an issue. Because the point is, what I'm trying to say is that you have a Fiscal Responsibility and Budget Management Act. This Fiscal Responsibility and Budget Management Act, if you look at many countries, it not only talks about the deficit of the government, it talks about the public sector deficit, consolidated public sector deficit. So consolidated public sector deficit means your public sector enterprises also wouldn't be able to borrow. So there is a voluntary restriction on them. So when the public sectors are not able to borrow and government deficit is put on an artificial limit of 3% or 4%, then what happens to the expenditure? How do they finance those expenditures? So I have some data on India, but I don't want to show that. We did some work, and there we find that if the rate of interest, which of late started coming down from the 2001 onwards, was at that level which it was in 2000-2001, the government deficit would have been much higher at around 5 to 6% of GDP. Now it is only 2.5% last year. So basically the softening of the interest rate and higher revenue mobilization during the last few years has helped in many occasions, despite that artificial restriction. But where the fiscal space is low, that means your revenue base is low, in those countries, and in our case in India, I keep coming back to India's data because I know about it, so I'm sorry about it also, but you see that there are poorer regions of the country where we find that there has been a huge decline in development spending. I have all those information. So if you look at spending on education, if you look at spending on health, if you look at spending on family welfare, if you look at spending on other measures of development in the infrastructure, you see there has been a rapid decline in the development spending to keep to this Fiscal Responsibility Act of 3%, because the poorest regions do not have a high tax base. So that is another issue I wanted to highlight. So to sum up, First is the tax. When you are talking about the fiscal policy, you are talking about tax, and I have said that, the tax policy issues and its constraints in the context of globalization. Second issue is debt. When you are talking about fiscal policy, debt, these artificial restrictions are not a valid one. That is very clear. Because when you are talking about debt, it is the question of tax that you require to impose to the society in future to pay the incremental interest payment. And it does not go up. It is very clear it does not go up if your economy is growing. That means if you are productively using the debt. That is third. Second, third issue is the issue of fiscal and monetary linkage in the context of financial liberalization. Now, in this context, I would like to say, as I said, that when there is a fiscal and monetary linkage in the context of financial liberalization, this is actually not only restricting the fiscal space, it's also squeezing the monetary space. That means your credit has been coming down because banks are finding it attractive to invest in government security. Their investment is going down. So there is a double blow, both from the monetary side as well as from the fiscal side because of these artificial restrictions. So I stop at that. I'm happy to take questions, comments.
Thanks very much. Now I have one problem. At the beginning of your presentation, you stated three roles of government. One is the allocation of resources, redistribution, and stabilization. Of course, one way government could maybe redistribute resources is by taxation. But it looks like this aspect is failing in most of the developing governments. I'll give you an example of Uganda. Early 19s, we borrowed money from the World Bank and the IMF. We, of course, implemented the structural adjustment programs. At the end of the day, of course, we got one of the highest, I think, growth rates in the world. That was around 6 to 7%. And over a number of years, about 10 or 15. But you know, the trickle-down effect of this growth rate failed. It was skewed to just a few people. And as a result, there was a widening gap between the poor and the rich. So the tax base actually shrank. So government could no longer collect enough taxes from the public and continued borrowing. Now, the borrowing became very unsustainable. Right now, we have the debt compared to GDP, actually the two are more or less the same. So it's no longer sustainable to borrow. We cannot borrow for production anymore. Now, what would you advise governments, maybe governments in the developing countries, to do? What tool can you really use to redistribute income? Because it seems these are the global policies actually increasingly making the poor pay more taxes than the rich. Actually, the rich people don't pay taxes; they just pass it over. So, what tool can we use to redistribute real income from the rich to the poor? This is where my problem is.
I would like to hear more about what you mentioned in the sustainability of that discussion. When you talked about the models that are used, by IMF, I suppose, the assumption that the expenditure elasticity is higher than the revenue elasticity, I suppose, with respect to the changes in income, is that empirically based, or do they assume it's constant? Doesn't it change?
The point is, when you have a deficit, that means your expenditure is always higher than your revenue. So if you calculate expenditure elasticity, you will always get it higher than your revenue elasticity. Then you get the point. This is very obvious. So now you put that into the intertemporal budget constraint, which we have, which is set for all the countries. Then you say that my GDP is going to grow at 12%, which is constant. That means what you are doing, that incremental borrowing that next 10 years I'll do, it will not add to any growth of GDP. So naturally, your debt GDP ratio will go up, your interest payment GDP ratio will go up, interest payment to revenue earning will go up. So then you will say that, look, it is unsustainable. But this is an obvious one. That's what I'm trying to say.
I mean, it's a little bit political question. Why, if there is no theoretical basis for all these fiscal responsibility budget management targets, then why IMF or organizations like IMF insist developing countries to implement those things? And one small question, that is, we are hearing nowadays in India about the revision of FRBM targets. Now, what is your take on that? Thank you.
This was very interesting, and I think in our countries, a big problem is the shifting of accountability. Because if people had to pay more tax and got some service provisioning, I think they would be okay, but they're reluctant to pay taxes, especially in the informal sector. First, because the way we engage in business is different. If you are in a developed country, you get support, you get information from government, you get some kind of a loan to start a business. When you are in our countries, it is a survival strategy to get involved in the informal sector. You start very small, and up after a certain number of years, maybe you get to some point, and you don't understand why you are a government that you've never seen, didn't educate you, didn't give you any thing to start with, all of a sudden is interested in the earning that you are making. And you are not seeing it in better roads where you would have to conduct your business, or better infrastructure. I think that is a big problem. And by the fact our governments are borrowing, I think they shift the accountability. Now they're accountable to deal with all the macroeconomic aggregates, but not to provide the services to the people. That is a big issue. And when you have the redistribution, you are taxing from the productive, which is mainly dominated by men, and putting into the reproductive. So you are kind of supporting gender equality in a way. But if you lose that fiscal space or that policy space to be able to implement such policies, you have problems. And last, I've seen in the negotiations between the European Union and the African countries for the economic partnership agreements, I think sometimes governments also make wrong choices, because in Mozambique, there are a certain number of products. They have a list of sensitive products or products to liberalize, which is negotiated. And one of the products they wanted to enter the country without paying tax is whiskey. I mean, who drinks whiskey? This was used to be a luxury good, and it is heavy taxation. But it's men using the product, not women. So why deprive the government from revenues coming from whiskey taxation? It doesn't make sense.
Thank you, Pinek, for that wonderful presentation. I have a comment on one of your first slides, actually, and it was about fiscal restrictions, and you were giving issues to consider in terms of fiscal restrictions. Actually, I saw one of them was don't borrow beyond a certain percentage or whatever. And then the other was don't go where private sector can do better. And this is one of those prescriptions that we normally get from our nice partners, the Bretton Woods institutions, where they are restricting spending, government spending on key areas, social services areas. Then the question is, Is it that the private sector can do better in terms of provisioning of social services? I feel that this is a little bit misleading because, and I liked the way you explained a public good, and you said it's something that you cannot exclude others from consumption. Now, if you look at human development, I look at that as a public good, because when my son is educated, I cannot exclude or restrict his services to my family or wherever. He'll contribute to the services of the state. So when expenditure is diverted from improving the quality of the human force, then in a way you are shifting the responsibility to the household. In other words, you are shifting a responsibility which should be publicly provided to the household. And I guess that is why we saw declines in enrollment rates during the structural adjustment periods, because you are entrusting such a big responsibility to the household. Then there was a slide where you were giving example of rates, taxation rates, and in one of them you said that it was an example of India, that if the home is registered, if home ownership is in the name of a woman, then the taxation rates are lower. But the issue is that and we have already heard this. It's ownership, you know, in terms of real value to the woman. You know, ownership is not enough. You know, I think it is also the control of that house. For instance, can the woman easily go to the bank and say, "Let me get a loan," because this house is registered in my name? Will she be free to do that? Because I see a situation where a man would decide to register a house in the name of a woman just simply to go for to avoid higher tax rates and go for lower rates.
Yeah, I think the trickle-down effect and inequality is something which is which happened in all the countries which have taken a structural adjustment program, and there is a huge increase in growth, and then that is not happening. And in fact, this is the story in my country also. But what policy would you suggest to reduce unsustainability issue? You see, this unsustainability issue, to me, to be very frank, is a non-issue. So the point is that these are all voluntary restrictions. If the government wants to spend, government really can spend. But these restrictions are put because you feel that 100% of GDP is unsustainable. Our debt is also 100% of GDP. I think if at all I want to look at my debt, which is a stock, I'd look it against my assets. GDP is not my asset. So if I look at India's debt in terms of assets of India, I think the asset liability ratio will not be even 5%. I don't know how much it will be, but it will definitely not be 100%. So you are actually, this measure itself is very problematic when you say that 100% of GDP is my debt. So what? It doesn't matter. That's my take on that. And it has got to do with how productive the government expenditure is and how it contributes to the growth and in turn in revenue. So basically enhancing the fiscal space to government expenditure. So unsustainability is not a very big concern. There are, you look at the history of debt, you will see that there are many countries during the World War, the first and second, their debt ratio increased to more than 200% of their GDP. Nothing happened to them. They are the growing industrialized economies of the world. So unsustainability, to my mind, one shouldn't be too worried about. And if at all you want to have a proper indicator, which is very difficult to do, you look at against your assets, not against your income. So of the country's income. What policy would you suggest to redistribute income? It's very difficult to answer, but I think it is both tax as well as expenditures. It cannot be one. So that has to be. So you need to have a progressive expenditure policy as well with progressive income taxation. So that is very important. Now, Tamar, I have answered. Why IMF insists? It's very simple, because IMF insists that there should be minimal government, more resources should be available, so private sector-led growth. So that's why you talk about central bank autonomy, that's why you talk about stable inflation, that's why you talk about no monetization, that's why you talk about smaller government. So that is, and I agree, because when there is no accountability, you don't see that the money which you are paying as taxes are really not reflected in the provisioning of public services that you get, really, there will be a tendency to avoid taxes and evade taxes. That is true. That's why evasion is very high. Other than the tax administration, people are not willing to pay taxes. In our country, people say that, well, why don't you pay more taxes? People will say that, no, the ministers will have a lot of foreign travel. I don't want to pay. That was that. It's like that, you know, it happens. So because you don't see that, it's really reflecting in your day-to-day life. So that is one that is very true. But this is a very complicated issue. But if you don't pay taxes, saying that I'm not getting money, the services that are being delivered, and then there is a restriction on the government borrowing. So how do you expect the government to perform? So there is an issue there. So the trust on government is important at one level. So good or bad, they'll become good over the years. So you have to have trust on government. So yes, whiskey taxation. That is why I was talking about the selective taxation is always bad. You tax this, you don't tax that. So when you have a selectivity, that is always subjective. If somebody thinks that whiskey is a tonic which is healthy and it should be out of taxes, that is his subjective assessment about whiskey. Now, that's why you cannot have such discretionary tax policy. That is precisely what I was talking about. You cannot favor a particular sector or a particular brand against others. So you should have a broad base, minimum tax rate, which has to be non-distortionary, so which doesn't alter individuals' choices. There should not be tax-induced choices and preferences when it comes to business taxation. That is the point which I'm trying to say. Yeah, your question, yes. This is what I'm trying to say is that minimal government argument was given by them. Now the point is that they also said that private sector can do better. But this is acknowledged that there are certain sectors which government can do better. So that is not my argument. I was just trying to put the arguments that are there. Yeah, the stamp duty on registration of property in the name of women. Well, this is the first step, because there are a lot of gender-based discrimination in many of the states in the country. And there the state governments have introduced that if the ownership is given into the name of women, this kind of gender-based violence at home and gender-based discrimination may come down. But one really doesn't know whether it has resulted in the second round of effect, like she become more independent, can have access to credit and things like that. I don't know. I haven't seen any work on that. But something very interesting, but I really don't know. So, when there is a structural adjustment program and you say that government should reduce spending, it always happens that spending declines in development, be it social sector, be it economic sector. That's why, as you have said, in the case of children's education and all, it becomes household responsibility rather than the government's, which is true in many countries, because you have a restrictions on borrowing, you have a restriction of resources, so that happens. Okay. Thanks.